Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Captain?
Not here.
Captain?
Report.
Signatures detected.
Shields up.
Signatures detected.
Red alert.
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair. Chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons.
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery. It's a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm one of those makers. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
How you doing, Adam?
I'm staring down the barrel of... Well, we're both staring down these barrels.
Like, it's a double-barreled stare down?
It's like Star Trek Donkey Kong, where nothing but barrels are rolling toward us. For an undetermined amount of time. That's the fun of the position we're in, where this is going to be the penultimate Greatest Discovery sandbox episode before the Lower Decks rewatch episode comes out 2 Tuesdays from now.
Right.
And then that very same week will be the premiere week of Lower Decks and also Star Trek Las Vegas at the same time. So much is happening in August.
So many things are in those barrels that we're staring down.
Right. There's one barrel that's just full of hooves.
Yeah.
That's the Star Trek Las Vegas barrel.
Yeah.
There's the series Lower Decks, and then behind Lower Decks, the barrel, are the rest of the new Star Trek seasons coming. Back to back.
Yeah, I mean, as far as we can tell, I think that there's a realistic future in which this is the last off-season The Greatest Discovery ever gets.
I know. No more Risa for us. No more saddles. No more anything.
What we did today is we watched a documentary about Star Trek The Next Generation, helmed by William Shatner, or at least hosted by William Shatner. He presented it.
This had been something I'd been curious about for a long time. This documentary came out in 2014, so it's been out for quite a while. One of the reasons I thought it would make a good subject for a Greatest Discovery is that early seasons of TV shows are often challenging in ways we don't understand right now, like concurrent to their creation.
Absolutely.
So like we're in the middle of the first one, two, or three seasons of these new Star Trek shows. Who knows what's going on behind the scenes?
Yeah.
And we learn from this documentary, things weren't always so rosy on TNG production. And chaotic places, you and I both know, Ben, are really challenging places to do creative work.
Challenging places to do your best work, for sure.
Yeah.
And I think that this, you know, really presents the story of those years from the victors' point of view.
Always. You know? Always. History is written by the winners, right?
They do have one interview subject in this movie that is definitely portrayed as the villain of the early years of TNG. But yeah, it's very interesting to think about this doc as it pertains to all television shows. I think that a lot of these kinds of things happen on first seasons. Mm-hmm. And then specifically first seasons of Star Trek shows when you are trying to take a beloved brand and a beloved universe that people really have a lot invested in and usher it into a new era of television. That is a really tough thing to do.
I mean, let's not forget that first season or two of Star Trek Discovery saw the sacking of their showrunners.
Right. Yeah. I think there's been so much turnover in the Discovery's writer's room that it's like, it's hard to believe that it's still a show.
Right. And yet by all accounts, great place to work by the people we've talked to anyway.
By the people we've talked to anyway. What they've been willing to tell us has been largely pretty positive.
And it's interesting you put it like that, Ben, because I think a documentary like this could only have been possible by someone like William Shatner. And I think my expectation before we get into talking about the movie was that this would be a film starring him.
Yeah.
And I was expecting that the entire way. I was pleasantly surprised at where he centers himself in the story. And the answer, I think, is as an audience to all of these people.
Yeah.
I think he's just a curious person about this.
It really seems that way. And he has so much of the gravity of the Star Trek universe is centered on his person that I feel like it does seem like people opened up to him in a way that they may have hesitated to just a fan film or something like that.
That has to be true. Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, let's get into it. It is a 2014 59-minute documentary. Ooh, love that runtime.
Give me those sub-1-hour docs.
It's William Shatner presents Chaos on the Bridge.
I love how this film starts with a preview to itself. It's great. It's totally like tell them what you're going to do to them and then tell them and then tell them what you've done. This is a documentary that uses a sex format.
It really does. It's talking dirty to us from jump, and it's showing us kind of the cast of characters and also setting up the kind of central metaphors of the film. We've got a country music card sharkin soundtrack. Mm-hmm.
A lot of hardcore twang,
a lot of poker chip imagery, and it's stated pretty explicitly right at the beginning. This is a movie about power and kind of Machiavellianism, like how Roddenberry and how the television network and how the people in charge of making this show wielded power and used power on each other, and how they got how this show came to be from the perspective of how did powerful people all collaborate to make it happen.
I think it's a really elegant level setting technology that Shatner uses here by making it about power, because I think it's super clear that the target audience for this documentary is the hardcore Star Trek fan.
Yeah.
And the hardcore Star Trek fan has very deeply rooted feelings about Gene Roddenberry and the rest of the creators of Star Trek. And I think you need to say something like this on the top of this story so that you can go in ready to have your preconceptions changed up a little bit, right?
Yeah. And this movie also starts with people contradicting each other. You know, like they pulled clips all through the film and brought them up to the front to show how different people's perspectives were on how some of this stuff went down.
No, Gene screwed over all his friends as well as his enemies.
But he was a nice man and he was a generous man.
They deserve to die, and I hope they burn in hell.
And in the center of it is Shatner himself. And I think one of the things that he dials down quite a bit is the idea that William Shatner knew Gene Roddenberry very well during many projects. And then Gene Roddenberry is described sort of as someone Shatner used to know in the beginning of this documentary. Like the imagery of Roddenberry being out in the desert is, you know, something that you and I have talked specifically about during live shows having to do with the Star Trek original series films.
Yeah.
And to see that in caricature form was pretty interesting and fairly brave.
I agree. I mean, I think that it makes it feel very miraculous that we got TNG and that TNG was a success and was more than just an also ran warmed over shitty modernization of TOS. Like it set a new precedent for television, and you don't hear about kind of washed up television writers getting a chance to helm a massive project like this. and like you hear it characterized like in different ways throughout the film. Like at some points they're talking about like, this is $100 million deal. These guys are like walking into the like executive boardroom at Paramount, and you know, people are like speaking in hushed tones as they mm-hmm. walk down the hallway. And then in other scenes, they're like, yeah, it's just a low budget kind of dog shit production. Like that doesn't really have enough money to do the like ambitious thing that they're trying to do.
Yeah. Like star wagons without sinks and bathrooms and stuff. And isn't it interesting that like your perspective is based on whether you're the executive class or the performance class of the project, right? The performers and the production people are seeing this project completely differently from the people in suits behind desks.
The people in suits behind desk are occasionally saying, oh, we need to free up $2 million in the overall budget of the network. We'll steal it from Star Trek.
Yeah. The film starts right away in demystifying Gene Roddenberry, disabusing the idea of him as a perfect science fiction creator, really giving us the story of a flawed man, you know, with respect to substance abuse and his flagging health and his extramarital relationships and stuff.
Yeah, they describe Majel Barrett Roddenberry as sending him kind of on a, like every weekend, she would send him to like a rehab facility, essentially.
Right.
Because like when he got TNG from the network, which was its own tricky negotiation, he has to clean himself up and dry out a little bit in order to be like ship shape to make the show.
Did this affect the level of sympathy that you had for him as someone who struggled so hard to get the power he used to have and then retain that power through the project of Star Trek The Next Generation?
Yeah, I think a little bit. I mean, it is sad. I think that the thing that is abundantly clear about Gene Roddenberry is that he was absolutely brilliant and incredibly creative. I mean, the level of detail of this world is so mind-boggling. And like when he is calling a writer into his office to berate them for not knowing the difference between shields and deflectors, it becomes clear that he like really passionately cares about it and takes it really seriously. And it's sad to think of somebody that created something like that, as meaningful as that to as many people as it is, kind of wallowing in self-pity and not able to create new things. Like when he is in the desert, you know, he's making failed pilots and you know, getting a little bit of like consulting money from the motion picture series, but he has really sidelined as a creator. And I think as a creator is where he really shone in his life. and many other parts of his life seem to be areas where he did very badly.
It's so affecting to think of a person who, you know, manages to get back on the horse and then so quickly is having mini strokes and walking into walls.
Yeah.
You know, in public.
Yeah.
Around people that he works with. And that was the part that I found the most affecting and sad about the end parts of Gene Roddenberry's life. It wasn't that I disagreed with his many methods for holding on to the power that he had. It was instead that it was really all he cared about toward the end, because if he cared about anything else, you're not going to be walking into walls in a conference room. You're going to be, you know, at home with your family, or you're going to be reading the newspaper by your backyard pool or whatever. Right. Like this was it.
You'll go to Tahiti and you'll stay there.
Yeah. Yeah. The problem was that he came back from Tahiti.
It almost feels like this movie is making the case that he worked himself to death. And that's pretty bleak.
I can both understand William Shatner's reluctance to like make a really strong case about that, and also admire his interest in just letting the viewer decide what happened and what the meaning is behind all of those scenes as told by the interview subjects.
Yeah. Speaking of the interview subjects, one problem I had with this movie from just a viewership standpoint is that they throw little lower thirds up on screen for the first time you see many of these interview subjects and then never do it again.
Yeah.
And I could not retain, like, was this guy like executive in charge of production at Paramount or Gene Roddenberry's personal assistant? I can't remember anymore.
I had to roll it back to get John Pike's credit specifically because he's in easily half of the movie.
Yeah.
And by the time I realized he was going to be one of its main characters, I had to roll it back and see that he was president of Paramount TV during the time of the story's telling, you know?
Do you think that that's where they got the name for the Captain Pike character?
I don't know. I found him really engaging as an interview subject. And I think when you're a documentary director, he's the type of personality that you want in that seat. Yeah.
He is, but he's also, like many, many of the other people on screen, does not treat Star Trek as a semi-holy property that, like, is special or distinct from other television shows. Like, the biggest laugh line of the movie for me was when he returned, like, the third time to yell about how he doesn't understand what Encounter and Farpoint was about.
What in the world is that thing that looks like a big jellyfish? Wow.
Like, he didn't get it at all and, like, was the person who was deciding whether this was happening.
It's amazing that you can be in a position of power like that where you're greenlighting or redlining a project for so much money and getting it isn't a qualification for that decision.
Right.
It's insane.
I mean, I'd say it's a bit like Jesse Thorne inviting us to bring our program, The Greatest Generation, to MaximumFun.org. It's like he listens to it and he's like, I don't know what this is, but he's like, I'm sure somebody will like it.
Worked out well for him, I'd say.
Yeah.
And it was a smash.
The other thing about, like, Pike specifically is there, you know, conversations about, like, the brinksmanship over, like, is the pilot going to be a 2-hour thing or a 1-hour thing? Is Gene Roddenberry going to be involved in the reboot of Star Trek? And that's where this character of Leonard Mazlish comes in, who is Gene Roddenberry's personal attorney, who seemed like the most interesting character in the film, and I was very sad that, I'm guessing he passed before they filmed this, so they don't have an interview with him.
With how he's caricatured in this film, though, like, are we sure he's dead? He seems like a gargoyle type person.
Yeah, maybe he absconded to Mexico with the budget for a 3-episode arc in a briefcase or something.
Yeah.
It's wild. Like, they talk about, like,
he's the only person everyone can agree about, right?
Yeah, he's the only person everybody can agree was, like, an out-and-out villain. The mm-hmm. other villain of the film, I would say, is Maurice Hurley. But mm-hmm. Maurice Hurley is not treated as just, like, downright evil.
Mm-hmm.
The way the attorney is. Because, like, he comes in to basically fight to get Roddenberry into the executive producer role on the show because Paramount owned Star Trek and could just do it without him if they wanted. But then he becomes this kind of, he's like haunting the writer's room and like going through people's personal files and stuff and really comes off as a terrible man.
He's standing right next to an open window, no screen, no anything. And I'm thinking it would be so easy to push that bastard out the window.
I wonder how common this is among the creative class, right? Like, creative people, and I include us in this description, our strengths are the work. It's not the administration around the work. And so right. I can understand Gene Roddenberry's interest in, like, finding someone to be his hitman a little bit, to actually go out and like, if you're a softie and a pushover, and your mind is on the creative, like, you're not often going to get what you need to to do your project. And I understand the utility in general of a Leonard Mazelish, but the specific instrument of a Leonard Mazelish, I think, could not possibly have been what Gene Roddenberry had in mind with his installation, right? Like, I understand the necessity for a guy like that, but him specifically seems truly awful.
One thing I kept having to remind myself, being a creative person, is that, like, this is an operation that is so many orders of magnitude bigger than anything I've ever been involved with.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Or I've will ever.
I've been on some sets where I had, I think 15 people working on a thing I was directing is probably the biggest I ever got. And for the last several years, like, the size of our team is like you and me and occasionally Rob.
Yeah. And I Rob like was when, a terrible Leonard Mazelish for us.
Yeah,
he just wasn't mean enough.
He wasn't cruel. He wasn't he wasn't as cutthroat.
Yeah.
He had too many morals.
Yeah.
I think. But like, the idea that Roddenberry may not have even been aware of some of this stuff, you know,
that's awful.
It's awful, and it boggles my mind, because I feel like, generally speaking, I'm aware of like most of the things that happen at the Uxbridge Shimoda Corporation.
I mean, and here's the order of operations thing to this kind of storytelling, is that Gene is set up to be a doddering, sick person. And then not long after, we're introduced to Leonard Mazelish as if there is a to B reason for that. Where, right. I'm not sure if that's true. You know, I don't believe that the reason that Leonard Mazelish was able to get away with what he did is because of Gene Roddenberry's flagging health. I think it's more likely that it was a leadership style problem where Gene might have been too loose or trusting of the people around him. I don't know. But then that is contradicted with what sort of grip he seemed to have over his creative.
Yeah, it's hard to parse. I think that one thing that this movie really highlights is how, like, they're not really simple conclusions in this story.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some kind of like grand conclusions about like Machiavellianism and John Pike being a poker player. Like, you can tell that Shatner admires the hell out of like the TV executives interviews.
I'm glad we're talking about motivation and stuff and drawing our own conclusions about some of these questions instead of arguing about whether or not William Shatner answered those in a way that makes sense, you know, on screen. Like, I'm really glad that at least Shatner stepped out of the way and isn't Absolutely. Drawing his own conclusions in front of us.
Yeah, because I don't think it's easy to like draw those conclusions, and I like that they aren't drawn explicitly.
Yeah. I think it's the failing of many documentaries is that the documentarian inserts themselves into the story.
Yeah. There are very few actors in this, and I thought that the selection of actors that they chose to interview was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
You've got Sir Patrick Stewart, you've got John DeLancey, you've got Jonathan Frakes, which, you know, if I ever got to sit down and interview him, I might hesitate to even ask him a question.
No way.
He just looks like he was having so much fun just being talked to, you know?
The gum in his mouth, though.
Yeah. I put that on Shatner. You got to tell your interview subject to take out the gum.
You got
to
get the gum. Got to get rid of the gum. But Frakes is a fucking director.
He should know that. Yeah.
He should know.
Do you think that's a power move?
I don't know. Like, it almost feels like he was just like wandering in a hallway on the Paramount lot, and Shatner was like, "Hey, you want to answer like four questions about TNG really quickly?" And he's like, "Yeah, I got 5 minutes for you."
When was the last time you had gum? I feel like gum as a thing is something I haven't had in a long time. Did gum go away? I feel like it's mints now.
I think that there are people that are like lifelong committed gum enthusiasts. Especially
the ex-smoker community, I bet, right? That's a thing.
Yeah. And then there's the rest of us for whom it is almost entirely useless.
I feel like that's just one of those inane questions you could ask a Jonathan Frakes if you were sitting next to him on an airplane.
Hey, you still chew gum?
And Frakes would just go on and on with a really interesting answer.
I saw you in a movie once chewing gum. Is that something you do? Like, where'd that come from? Is that like an affect? The other actors that are in it are Denise Crosby, Gates McFadden, and Diana Muldaur. Mm-hmm. And they provide some pretty interesting perspective on whence potted plants, I think. Mm. And this is something that we've talked about a ton on The Greatest Generation, why the women on the Enterprise D are so underwritten relative to their male counterparts. And I didn't ever really know specifically why Denise Crosby left the cast before this, but she explains, like, I didn't get any lines. I didn't get anything to do. I wanted them to make fake legs so that when they were close up on Peace Stew, I didn't have to be standing at the horseshoe behind him.
I took some umbrage with John Pike and his comment about, you know, Denise Crosby wanting to go be a movie star as a result. And like, it's easy to retrospectively roll your eyes at someone else's career ambitions, but fuck that.
Yeah.
John Pike. Like, and also fuck that Bill Shatner. Like, that part didn't need to be in the movie. Like, the reaction to Denise Crosby's quite valid description of her time on the show and her interest in, you know, acting more, just period, just acting more.
Just getting more stuff to do.
Yeah.
And he turns it into a personal attack on her talent specifically. Like, he's like, yeah, she's a real pretty face, but she's no Katharine Hepburn or something like that. And it's just like, don't say things like that, period. And especially not when a camera is on you. Because now Denise Crosby, if she like goes to the premiere of this film, has to fucking sit there and see you saying it. Fuck that.
It's worth talking about because this is one of the few times it happens in the film where a creative choice is made as a documentarian to like make someone who's participating in the documentary not look good.
Yeah. And I think that Pike is left to kind of twist in the wind on some of the pretty impolitic things that he says.
Yeah. yeah. He's definitely not squeaky clean.
And similarly... though to a much smaller extent. I love Dr. Pulaski as a character, but Diana Muldaur bodies TNG in the single line of hers that they edited into this documentary.
They were not that interested in renewing me, and I was certainly not that interested.
If she ever like wanted to win over the TNG fan base for Dr. Pulaski, she canceled her ability to do so in this movie.
It's interesting how Patrick Stewart sort of recovered from his dismissiveness of the cast as being non-serious about things, but Diana Muldaur like never changed her mind about that.
She's like, this isn't a show, this is just a bunch of models and sets and crazy technology with actors,
you know,
populating it.
But what's so interesting about that is, and this is something that Ira Stephen Bear says, like the first two seasons are unwatchable because they're about plot and the third season is about character.
Yeah.
And I think they're talking about the same problem.
Squarespace. Got to build yourself a website if you want to stand out online. Social media websites are not cutting it anymore. And you really can't tell the story of what you do and sell your products or services or time effectively without a really great looking website. Squarespace is the way to do it. Using Squarespace Blueprint, you can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options. You make a seamless checkout option for your customers. You can accept PayPal, Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Amazing. So head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/trek to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to, oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
So Maurice Hurley is a name that I didn't really know. As a lifelong TNG fan, I was not, I don't think his name ever really registered for me on the opening credits, but he was essentially the showrunner for seasons one and two, and is the secondary villain of this movie.
Yeah.
And the movie almost feels like it's making fun of him.
Gene's ideas about the future and about man are wacky doodle.
But he's like a cop show writer who's extremely proud of his work on cop shows. Like, he lists his credits previous to TNG and talks about how great all of these shows were, and then talks with immense disdain for the like kind of future that Roddenberry predicts. But also was apparently like the hardest assed follower of the rules that Roddenberry set out for how they would tell stories on Star Trek The Next Generation, which were like the no interpersonal conflicts between the main cast kind of rules that we've talked about a ton.
It's interesting that like in the checks and balances of Star Trek The Next Generation, there was like the executive branch of Gene Roddenberry, the judicial branch of Leonard Majlisch, and the executive branch of Maurice Hurley. Because at times, Maurice Hurley talks about, you know, carrying Gene's water. But then out of the other side of his mouth, he's like, Gene didn't want a writer's room. Gene wanted ghostwriters, basically. And I'm paraphrasing his description of what happened between Gene and the writers. But and then their relationship is brought to a head where he threatens to leave, but Roddenberry says that like he'll leave if Hurley stays. And then Roddenberry and Majel Barrett Roddenberry go to Tahiti, and then like everything changes.
And it's not that it didn't really seem like everything changed for the better. It just changed for the like more hard line and more, I mean, and Michael Piller coming in is discussed as being like a real turning point for the series when it started to get good, when it started to become the thing that people really love. And I mean, that's also complicated by the fact that so many of the things that they use to great effect story-wise in seasons 3 through 7 are ideas that were brought into the series in season one, you know?
Right. There really does seem to be a tension among the interview subjects about who's responsible for that, though, you know?
Yeah. And I think that, like, one of the things that really struck me about the writers specifically is how, like, self-important they can get. Like, all of them, like, both, you know, from the Maurice Hurley side, but also, you know, Brandon Braga and DC Fontana are all interviewed in this. And like, there's some smugness by the writers of like wanting to be kind of treated as like the people who really make the show.
Right.
And I think that that's like a, you know, when you're as far behind the camera as a writer is, it can be pretty frustrating to see all of the like love and adulation poured on other people when you feel like it's your story or whatever.
In a documentary ostensibly about power, it's super interesting to see a documentary full of interviews with actors cede that power.
Yeah.
Almost constantly throughout the film, we're hearing about how little power Patrick Stewart had.
Yeah.
And the rest of the actors. And this is a film made by the Star Trek actor of all time. And it's interesting how okay Bill Shatner is about telling that kind of story and allowing it to be told in this way.
Yeah. I loved the part about the Today Show coming to film on the set of TNG and... like, Pizdu comes across as being very humorless in this, or at least having been humorless at the time he was making TNG, because he's like, we can't have any, like, jokey stuff. We can't have anything that, like, makes light of Star Trek in this Today Show stuff that we're doing. And, like, he swears on live television and storms off the set.
Mood's a thing for cattle and love play.
And then gets in tons of trouble with the... with the network boss.
Were you clear about how many of these interviews were done for Shatner and which interviews were taken from previous interviews and moved into this documentary? Because I can't remember a shot with Shatner and Stewart in the same room.
Yeah, I don't think they are.
Yeah.
I think they shot a lot of this at JPL
yeah.
in that control room,
yeah.
which, you know, like...
As a composition, it's super interesting to have like deep background photographs
like people,
help
like
illustrate
NASA
the story.
People doing stuff, like mm-hmm. doing real NASA stuff. I imagine if you're Bill Shatner, you can call JPL and say, "Hi, this is Bill Shatner. I would like to come use your facility to shoot a series of interviews." And everybody there is like, "Cool.
Yeah.
Can we shake your hand when you come?"
Yeah. It's so hard if you're doing a bunch of interviews to make them look different and interesting in a project like this. And I think JPL as a setting is great for this sort of project.
Yeah, I agree. But to your point, I don't think that Pizdu interview feels the same. And I think you're probably right that it was like either shot elsewhere, shot backstage at a Star Trek convention or shot for something else and just licensed into this film.
That's why the tone just feels different with a few of these interview subjects and Patrick Stewart being one of them, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he's not a humorless person. I thought that story of him cursing and walking off the set when the weatherman put on his uniform is emblematic of that. Like, that was awesome. An awesome move by him. And then, like, the conflict between him and John Pike in the aftermath, like John Pike is set up to be like the ball breaker who never loses a hand of studio poker.
Right.
But he showed his cards at the end of that. And that's what redeems the John Pike character in the documentary. Like,
yeah.
like that he is humanized in that moment.
Yeah. It's, it's funny. I mean, I was watching this with an eye to thinking about Star Trek Picard as well.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting the journey Patrick Stewart has had with this character and this franchise, because he has spoken a lot publicly about how he like never unpacked his bags for the first several episodes of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And he really does seem to have a in this era, in the, you know, in this like first three seasons era, really does seem to have a love-hate relationship with the material and the people he's working with, and like really wanting to take it seriously, but all the American actors are always like goofing around and playing grab ass on the set.
No gags, no jokes, no fooling around.
And he hates that, and then like wants the character to have like more interesting character moments, but you know, is also like prickly and recalcitrant in, you know, moments where he could be like humanizing himself. And now he's like reviving it in an executive producer and star capacity.
Yeah, I wonder how often he thinks about what happened to him during early TNG. Maybe we'll get the chance to ask him one day.
Yeah.
One of the things I read about this documentary is that William Shatner and Maurice Hurley have been friends for decades, like hangout friends. And that Maurice Hurley, after he walked off the Paramount lot, you know, clapped his hands together and said, I'm done with this shit. Like famously never talked about his time there really at all until this documentary. And I think that's got to be so exciting if you're a documentary minded person to go like, well, this is a story that has never been told from this perspective. If I can just get this one central character in place, I can build around it. And you can see when you watch this documentary, how that came to be. Like we're backfilling these stories with these other characters around Maurice Hurley. We're installing the secondary character of John Pike. Right. And then we're seasoning it throughout the rest of the hour. And I think it's an effective way to tell this story. I thought it worked.
I did too. I wonder how Maurice Hurley felt about Shatner after this doc, because I don't think he comes off looking that good.
I don't think he comes off as someone who cares about how he looks, though, in a way that effectively describes his character to me as a person.
Yeah, you might be right. One thing that the film gets at one point, I think maybe it's with the Brandon Braga section where they're interviewing him, is the idea that Gene Roddenberry sort of imagined himself as a Kirk type in the when he was making TOS, and sort of imagined himself as a Picard type when he was making TNG. Like, and they go so far as to like Photoshop his head onto the characters' bodies in the extensive animated graphics that form the backbone of this film's visual language.
You kind of say that derisively. Did you not enjoy that part of it?
No, I thought that was very enjoyable, and a perspective on those two characters that I had never heard before. I mean, if there is one thing that is derisive about it, is the way this film talks about the fans who are depicted as like actively protesting in the streets about my Star
like
Trek.
Dumpsters on fire and like rolling over cars.
But yeah, like I think it's very interesting that Picard is the like wise older man by the time they make TNG. And it's not like it seems like Roddenberry was the main person resisting the calls to make the captain on the new ship be like a fuckboy the way Jim Kirk was.
Right. As a creative person goes through the seasons of their life, I think they see their hero figures change along with them. And maybe that's what we got here.
And I wonder if that was at all influenced by the way the Kirk character changes in the films. Like like his arc in the films is about like transitioning into being an older man and being maybe not the like young adventure swashbuckling type that he once was, and
regretting mistakes made and opportunities not taken and stuff.
Right. And it seems like Picard is very much in dialogue with that presentation of Kirk.
Yeah.
As much as he is in dialogue with the original series era presentation of Kirk. Like, could you be a older man that isn't full of regrets and is more like self-confident and proud of the accomplishments that he's already made and is there helming the flagship of the fleet because he deserves to be? And that's sort of an amazing thing for Roddenberry to have written somewhat about himself.
Yeah, it makes me wonder to what extent Shatner is self-aware enough to see himself in that kind of story as well, you know?
Yeah.
He's someone who has grown into someone super comfortable with his flaws and his interests and for better or worse, you know?
I think so.
So by the end of the film, we get our final like rescue 911 moment where Shatner walks into frame and ties the whole thing up. You know, TNG ended up, you know, it was a difficult birth, but Star Trek The Next Generation ended up as a great success. And he contextualizes it in terms of the awards that it received. And I thought that was an interesting way for him to do that. It was less about it being a a work that was recognized critically as something good. Though I guess when you recognize a work with awards, you know, that those go hand in hand. But like, TNG is beloved.
Right.
And you could make the argument that it's more beloved than some of the other Star Trek franchises. That's something William Shatner would never say, especially in a documentary like this.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that in his wrap up, he's like, yeah, won some statues. Things ended up being okay for everyone involved.
Even though it wasn't a network show, it was a first run syndication show. It got some Emmys. Can you believe it?
He kind of tweaks the nipple of the thing before walking off. And then like he kind of steals the Valor by using the last scene from TNG's last episode, which for some reason is not in HD compared to the other HD clips that we get from TNG in the documentary. And that's the end of the thing.
It's a love letter in a lot of ways. It is very much focused on like the business and brinksmanship. Like there's a lot of you know, discussion of the optimism for the future and the humanism stuff that Roddenberry put into the show. But I'd say largely the drama and brinksmanship in this are about business decisions and creative differences. And ironically, all of the conflict that was happening on this show behind the scenes when interpersonal conflict was like essentially forbidden from being presented on screen.
Yeah.
But it really does feel like a loving tribute at the end of the day, which is not something that I would necessarily have predicted Shatner be there for.
Not so wacky doodle after all.
Did you like this documentary, Ben?
I did. Maybe like if I have some criticisms of it, it's a little bit over obsessed with the term wacky doodle and a little bit light on explanations about what went down with the lawyer and that like that whole chapter. But I learned a ton about a thing I really love, and I love thinking about Star Trek The Next Generation, and I love thinking about these characters and like how we got to where we got with them. And I think it's really to Shatner's credit as a director that he explores as many elements of the story as he does with the short 59-minute runtime of this film. Like, I was blown away that we were able to get stuff about like writers feeling jilted by the way promotions happened.
Yeah, the DC Fontana part was incredible to me, how Gene wedged his way into that credit, which is like so consistent with his whole deal, like how he wrote lyrics to the TOS theme song to get more money. Like it's so craven.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, I thought it was a really interesting film. And if you are a fan of TNG and you can find a way to watch this movie, I would recommend it. How about you?
Yeah, I liked it too. And I think I liked it more in proportion to what I was expecting.
Yeah.
Because I was expecting kind of a grudgy tabloid-like documentary.
Right.
But I was so satisfied and happy and surprised with just how basically curious it was about what happened. And I think there's been a lot of talk lately about documentary ethics. I think, you know, one instance that is very current is has to do with the Anthony Bourdain documentary that, depending on when you're hearing this episode, is either about to come out or has been out already. And like the ethics of using artificial intelligence to manipulate a person's words into saying what you want them to say. Like, a documentary is only as strong as the ethics of the documentarian.
Right.
And I thought Shatner conducted himself with ethics that I admire.
Mm-hmm.
He got out of the way of the thing, and I was happy that he did. I think it's more difficult to tell a forensic story than what is told here, which is, I think, of as more of an emotional retelling of a thing.
Right. Yeah. You kind of get the gestalt of what the chaos was without I don't think that like we are in a courtroom putting seasons 1 through 3 of TNG on trial.
But when you set it up as a story about power, and with how subjective a story about power is,
yeah,
I think this documentary was successful in articulating that story. You know, because stories about power are better told emotionally than academically or factually.
I totally agree. Do you want to see what kind of stories we have in the Priority One inbox, Adam?
Yeah, those are the facts.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
We've got a couple of P1s here. The first one is of a promotional nature, Adam, and it goes like this. What's missing from your life? If, by some small chance, it's a bald white guy living in Hong Kong streaming Pokemon Go IRL and learning Japanese with Duolingo, then you are in luck. Follow Anthony Kelly Yip on Twitch before it gets banned here because of that thing Ben and Adam said. P.S. This is a small channel. I'm not that great with people, so if you could discuss it amongst yourselves and limit any new followers to, like, less than 6, that would be great. P.P.S. Subscribe to Ben and Adam. They're nice. So check out twitch.tv/AnthonyKellyYip. That's Anthony, KellyYIP. And he says, I was going to share my website, but who knows when this will air, and I spent my renewal money on a P1.
Can I just say that I feel a great affinity for Anthony Kelly Yip, because Anthony Kelly Yip shoots their shot, and then almost as soon as the ball leaves their hand, there are some regrets about shooting the shot. And I know that feeling so well.
Yeah, can relate. Well, that sounds like a very fun Twitch. It's just it's Pokemon Go IRL and Japanese in Duolingo, but from Hong Kong?
I'm going to have to flip open the Duolingo Japanese style. I've been dabbling with the Polish for a while.
Oh, yeah?
But I think I got to bring back the Japan Duolingo. I want to go back to Japan.
I've been learning Yiddish in Duolingo. I wonder how much we could communicate Polish to Yiddish.
We can barely communicate with each other in English, Ben.
Fair enough.
It's totally fakakta.
Uh-huh.
Ben, our second Priority One message is of a personal nature. It's to you and me.
Whoa.
And it's from Mike Mock and, you know, Kristar Shrimp Colgar, don't you?
Yeah, that tends to be a package deal, those three.
Message goes like this. What are your thoughts on Upper Deckers? Please be specific. Well, Mike Mock and Kristar Shrimp Colgar, I think much like the jokey sex acts of like the Flying Camel or the Dirty Sanchez or any of those other like awful
things that people in 2008 would walk around and say to each other.
I don't think Upper Deckers are a real thing. I'm going to say that right now. I think they're jokes that people talk about doing, but no one ever does it.
You'd really have to be a bad person to do it.
Ben, you just got a toilet without a tank, didn't you? How are you supposed to upper deck that thing?
I did, and I specifically got it to reduce the likelihood
the amount
of
upper deckers happening at your house. Yeah,
because it's kind of been a plague over here.
It's so weird that it's just you and your wife living during quarantine and so many upper deckers happening.
Yeah, but we ordered it from Costco, that toilet, and like all of the major purchases we've made at Costco, it didn't work, and it was a nightmare to return it. So
I'm not going to brook any Costco hate in these parts.
Oh, really? So
I love that.
So you like
company.
A company that sells expensive products that are exclusively bad and non-functional?
They made it right, didn't they?
Eventually. It took hours of my life I spent on hold getting rid of this fucking toilet. But so now we have a toilet that does have a tank, and it works.
Costco is an ancient company run in an ancient way, and all of their problems are self-inflicted because of those reasons.
Let's sell people major appliances and key pieces of their restroom, but have them be kind of bad and like for example, if it's a toilet, you want the poop to kind of stay in it when you press flush.
You
the
should
poop
have
just
gotten
stays.
A Kirkland signature toilet, Ben. That's your problem.
Yeah, well, they didn't have a tankless option, and that was the main selling point, was no upper decker. It's like, hey, you're not going to get upper deckers, but the shit is going to be stuck in the bowl. So,
you know what?
What's
it's
the
same difference, right? you had a lower decker is what you had.
I had a lower decker.
Hey, guess and, what? That would make a great name for a Lower Decks podcast. We should just put that out there because everything we say gets turned into the title of a podcast.
It really does. Yeah, yeah. If you would like to start a Lower Decks podcast, just refer to this or any previous thing we've said about it. And I'm sure you'll find a title in there somewhere.
Well, thanks to Anthony Kelly Yip and Mike Mock and Chris Darshrimp Kolgar for their Priority One messages.
Yeah, thank you.
We've got an entire season of Lower Decks and new Star Trek coming up and slots available for Priority One messages. You can create your own over at MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. And, and they really support the production of the show, will be never ending. Starting in 2 weeks. Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you discover yourself and Edward Larkin?
Edward Larkin! I think I'm going to give it to Ira Stephen Bear.
Gotta do that. Did he get the Larkin for the DS9 documentary? I can't remember.
There was the What We Left Behind documentary that we reviewed in the bonus feed.
This is not our first documentary review.
Yeah, and I don't remember who the drunk Shimodas were on that, but it's very likely that he was among them.
Mm-hmm.
I laughed out loud when it was revealed that we have Ira Stephen Bear to thank for the invention of RISA.
Uh-huh. Thanks.
I loved that Roddenberry wanted it to be way more like pansexual than it was depicted as on the show. That was really cool. That was kind of an amazing revelation. And I loved that, like, he seemed like a kid in a candy shop telling that story, like how excited he was to write it as sexually permissive as Roddenberry had implied, and then like getting told by the suits, no, you can't do that. This is 1991 or whatever.
He really seems to be the type that forces that into a conversation. Like, you know, I made RISA.
Yeah.
Don't you? You know, that was me.
Yeah. Get a load of this goatee. Guess what's not going to shock you? I invented the fuck planet. Did you have an Edward Larkin, Adam?
A related Larkin. I'm going to go with Brandon Braga, and here's why.
Wow.
He seems to have taken great care at looking cool in this documentary. Like, I wonder to what extent he participated in the set design of his location. Like, it was very dark where he was. The lighting was very moody. He looked very cool in like a deep V shirt with a chain and like cool glasses. Like, he puts a different spin on looking cool than Ira Stephen Bear.
Yeah.
And one that I think it's just funny to think of, like, he's not an in front of the camera person, but he seems to have just as great of a sense of vanity as any of the actors involved in this project, and I found that fascinating.
It's very funny when you're in those scenes and you cut from Brandon Braga to old Shatner, who is like,
yeah.
Shatner at this point kind of always looks like he might be about to cry.
Yeah.
And is a little red in the face and like is, you know, like not an unhandsome man, but
yeah.
The contrast between the two of them is very striking, given what a sex symbol Shatner was when he was a young man.
As a project, it seems like a challenge to maintain that kind of continuity, like to cut between a Brandon Braga interview to what a Patrick Stewart interview looks like, with like the curtains in the back and the corporate video lighting.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's difficult to maintain that throughout. And and it's not maintained, which is what makes us an interview like Brandon Braga's stick out the way that it did to me, and that's why he's my Edward Larkin.
Good Larkin, buddy. Well, as we discussed, next episode of The Greatest Discovery, we're going to do our season one recap of Star Trek Lower Decks. I'm really excited because we didn't get to do any season recaps in the 27 weeks of New Trek or whatever that we had last time we were in the on season. And Lower Decks is a show I really enjoyed the first season of, so I'm looking forward to revisiting it. And then after that, we are going to be cracking in to Lower Decks itself. New episodes coming really soon.
Yeah, it's all happening at once.
It sure is.
And we hope you stick around for it.
Yeah. Thanks to everyone that tuned in for this one. And here go some credits.
The Greatest Discovery is an Uxbridge Shimoda podcast on the Maximum Fun Network. And your support makes it possible. We thank those who support The Greatest Discovery on a monthly subscription-style basis. And you can join them by going to MaximumFun.org/join. Be sure to follow @GreatestTrek on Twitter and Instagram. Those accounts are a regular source of fun thanks to our social media director, Bill Tilly, the Card Daddy. Thanks to Adam Ragusea, who made our theme and interstitial music. When he's not making music for us, Adam can be found cooking food on his tremendously popular YouTube channel for his millions of subscribers. Fans of the show call themselves Friends of DeSoto, and you can make friends with them at the many fan-created communities on Discord at DrunkShimoda.com, Facebook, Reddit, and all the rest. For our next episode, we'll be doing a full Season 1 retrospective about Star Trek Lower Decks to prepare for its Season 2 premiere on August 12th. Then the following Tuesday, The Greatest Discovery will be back weekly, recapping all the fun of Lower Decks, as well as all the new Star Trek shows in the months ahead. So we'll see you next time for that on The Greatest Discovery.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.